A wise man once said, "This is the show what I wrote." That's a Morecambe and Wise man on Morecambe and Wise on Historical Hysterials. Yes, good afternoon, good evening, and good morning, everybody. It's time once again for Historical Hystericals. I'm Chris Brennan.
And I'm Commander Mike, and welcome to Historical Hystericals, the podcast.
Yes,
I think I'll start calling it that, the Historical Hystericals, the podcast, just to make it different from Historical Hystericals, the live show.
Or Historical Hystericals, the movie.
Yeah, the
stage show. When's that coming out?
You didn't get the email?
No, I didn't, no.
Oh. Well, let's talk about that. Oh, that reminds me. Listen at the end of the program for a very special announcement.
About our live show.
You're not getting your emails,
emails at all, no. Oh, dear. Ernie Wise and Eric Morecambe.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this one for a while because it's another great example of people working very hard for a long time to become an overnight success.
And that's the way it is. If you want to be an overnight success, you've got to work at it and stick to it.
Absolutely. And these guys are a great example. From England, Ernie Wise and Eric Morecambe. I love it. We'll start off with the oldest one, which was Ernie.
The Ernst Wiles.
Ernest Wiseman, where he was born, in Bramley in Leeds in England. His parents were Harry and Connie Wiseman, and he's the eldest of five children.
Five children.
Yep. He changed his name to go into show business.
Not to get away from the other four children.
Probably that as well. He attended first a Thorpe Infant Junior School and then East Ardsley Boys School, but entered the entertainment industry in 1933, appearing as an actor and singer in music hall. Now, his father, who was a railway lamp man, was also a semi-professional singer, and they appeared together under the name Bert Carson and His Little Wonder.
Oh, God.
He started making solo appearances, singing, dancing and telling jokes in 1936, and in the autumn of 1938, he came to the attention of Brian Michie, a leading vaudeville talent spotter, and he was recommended to the impresario Jack Hilton. In 1940, he appeared in the review called Youth Takes a Bow, and this is where he met Eric Morecambe.
Now, let me tell you a little bit about Eric Morecambe. Now, Eric Morecambe was born John Eric Bartholomew to George and Sadie Bartholomew. Sadie took work as a waitress to raise money for his dancing lessons, and during this period, Eric Bartholomew won numerous talent contests, including one in Hoytack in 1940. The prize for which was an audition in Manchester with Jack Hylton. I think we mentioned him earlier,
Hilton,
didn't we?
Hilton.
How would you say that? H-Y-L-T-O-N.
I think it's Hilton.
Hilton. Okay, Jack Hilton. 3 months after the audition, Hilton invited... Hilton invited Eric to join a review called Youth Takes a Bow. Now, we've heard that name before.
Yeah.
At the Nottingham Empire, and that's where he first met Ernest Wiseman. The two soon became very close friends, and with Sadie's encouragement, started to develop a double act.
Now, the two were eventually allowed to perform their double act on stage in addition to their solo spots. Hilton was so impressed, he made it a regular feature of the review. They made their debut together as Bartholomew and Wise on August 28, 1941, at the Liverpool Empire. A change of name followed in the following autumn. For a time, they considered the combination of their prospective places of birth, Morecambe and Leeds, but that would make the act sound too much like a cheap day return, so they settled for Morecambe and Wise.
A wise move, as they say. Now, taking inspiration from their movie heroes, Laurel and Hardy, and the word players of the more recently successful Abbott and Costello, the duo was soon featured in the West End production A Strike a New Note, and were able to witness the nightly routines of legendary Sid Field and his straight man, Jerry Desmond. If you say straight man, and it sounds kind of like you're talking about the other sort of straight man.
Yeah, times do change.
They do, don't they?
Yes. Mm.
Field's overnight success, in Talking Mike's overnight success, with the show had taken years of hard work to achieve, and Morecambe and Wise would spend just as long climbing their way up the ladder of show business. War service interrupted the budding act, Ernie in the Merchant Navy, while Eric was a Bevan boy. Now, what is a Bevan boy?
Now, a Bevan boy, in the British conscription system, some were conscripted into the army or air force or in the military, and some were sent off to the coal mines.
Ah, so they were sort of mining coal for the war effort.
Yeah. Keep the home fires burning, keep the industries going to build tanks and whatever.
So how did they pick who got to be a Bevan boy?
Chosen at random from the conscripts, and there were also a few volunteers. There were nearly 48,000 Bevan boys at the time who performed a vital but largely unrecognised service in the mines. Now, a lot of them weren't released from service until years after the war had ended.
Well, when you think about it, they were probably underground, so no one told them the war had ended.
Yeah. So it was about 10% of those conscripted between the ages of 18 to 25 were selected for the mines.
Wow, that's kind of an unsung little part of British history you don't know about, isn't
it? Not heard of it before I'd researched this myself. It's good fun.
After war service, the pair struggled to secure dates with touring shows and in variety theatres, but by the early 1950s, they were popular enough to gain radio spots on variety fanfare and workers' playtime.
By 1953, engagements in pantomimes and summer seasons also included their own radio series on the Northern Home Service. It was called Your Only Young Once, which ran into three seasons and a number of episodes were broadcast nationally on the Light program. At the same time, Ronnie Waldman, the head of Light Entertainment at the BBC, offered Morecambe and Wise their first television series, Running Wild. But the venture was a huge disappointment.
Its reviews included things like poorly written, inadequately prepared, and it exposed the duo's inexperience. The only thing wild about the show was the critical hostility towards them. Six episodes were planned, but by the third, Morecambe and Wise were desperate for the series to be dropped. However, it dragged on, and Waldman's insistence to the show going on was a huge embarrassment for the pair. Depressing in the end.
Mm. One newspaper review said, "Definition of the week, TV set, the box in which they buried Morecambe and Wise."
Oh, that's nasty.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Eric apparently carried this review around with him ever after from then on, and Ernie kept a tight control over their material.
I can understand that. I mean, they want to put their best foot forward, and if they're relying on other people to write material for them, that is just not working.
There's a lot of trust you could put in someone else when you write when they write material.
Says me reading your script. Fortunately, only a small percentage of the population possessed TV sets at this time, so the damage was not irreparable. They spent the ensuing years perfecting their timing and routines and renewing their self-confidence.
Commercial television began in Britain soon after, and in the mid-1957, ATV signed them as a comedy support to Winifred Atwell, performing scripts by Johnny Spigot, the future Death to Us Part writer, who saw enormous potential in Eric and Ernie, and was probably the first to create material that concentrated on their characters.
In 1958, they were back on the BBC screens, making appearances on Double Six, before embarking on a successful six-month tour of Australia. Now, you probably remember that, Mike.
Not quite.
No? Upon their return, Eric and Ernie were shocked to note the change the coming of commercial television had caused to the variety stage, with theatres closing across the country as audiences stayed home to watch the electronic giggle box in their living rooms, as they do now. With their futures uncertain, they hired a new agent by the name of Billy Marsh, whose drive and expertise soon had them booked for dozens of appearances on such shows as Star Time, Saturday Spectacular, and Sunday Night at the London Palladium. At the Leyden Palladium. The most chaotic decade of their career had begun, and Morecambe and Wise were on the threshold of national stardom.
Initial approaches to Lou Grade for a series at ATV were unsuccessful, while at the same time the BBC appeared keen to sign the pair, and even had six scripts prepared. But in 1961, Lou Grade suddenly changed his mind and agreed to sign them to a prime weekly time slot. For their part, Eric and Ernie insisted the show engage the writers Sid Green and Dick Hills, who had been recommended to them by Ginny Jewell and Ben Warris, old friends from the old music hall circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to note that Ernie was the driving force in all contract negotiations for the team.
As Sid Green, that name rings a bell.
Oh, it'll come up a bit later on because they appeared a bit later on a couple of their recordings.
Oh, there we go. Now, the first episode of Two of a Kind aired in October of 1961, which found the stars lost in a procession of sketches surrounded by an army of supporting actors. Fearing a repeat of Running Wild, the failure of Running Wild, Eric and Ernie decided to take a stand, but just before a confrontation occurred, Actors Equity suddenly went out on strike, mainly because they heard me pronouncing their title. The result was a much less cluttered presentation, with Eric and Ernie, who, as members of the Variety Artists Federation, were still able to appear squarely in the spotlight for the show. There was even a touch of irony with their writers Sid and Dick forced to appear as bit players in some of the sketches. As the series progressed, audience figures increased, and the two North Country comics, after 20 years together, finally had their overnight success.
Essential to this success were the scripts by Sid Green and Dick Hills, or Sid and Dick as they are popularly known from their almost wordless appearances in the show's sketches. Each half-hour edition of Two of a Kind had a strong variety flavour, including a band number, a vocal spot to a separate couple of lengthy comedy routines, with shorter pieces at the opening and closing. By the second season, the following June, the show was moved to a regular Saturday evening time slot where it stayed for all but the last ATV season.
Two of a Kind opened the doors for Eric and Ernie to gain international stardom, to a degree. In February 1964, several seasons of the show began appearing on Australian television screens with the ABC. The ABC eventually aired all the episodes from seasons 2, 3 and 4. And we can probably find them somewhere on YouTube, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Later that year, an enthusiastic Ed Sullivan was in the audience of their London Palladium shows in support of Bruce Forsyth and signed them for appearances on his top-rated Sunday night CBS series. Thus began a strenuous period of transatlantic flights, which would continue until May 1968. And they did a total of, I think, about 17 guest spots.
You've got to remember that the Ed Sullivan Show was the place to get exposure in America. This is where the Beatles were introduced to Americans. This is where Elvis Presley made his first television appearance.
Mm.
So very, very influential.
The place to be. Morecambe and Wise's television popularity led to their 1964 movie debut in the big screen, send-up, of James Bond's phenomenal The Intelligence Men, also known as Spylarks, written by Hills and Green, who could be seen in brief walk-ons on the movie. It was an enjoyable, if unexceptional, outing. It made enough money to be followed by the next film, The Riviera Touch, a couple of years later, and The Magnificent Two-O, or The Magnificent Two, in 1967.
After five increasingly successful seasons on ATV, Lou Grade capitalised on Eric and Ernie's ongoing exposure to the Americans via The Ed Sullivan Show by signing a deal with the US ABC network to screen their new seasons of one-hour programmes, which, as a result, would be made in colour.
Colour.
Rechristened Piccadilly Palace, there they were scheduled as a summer replacement for the Hollywood Palace time slot. It aired several months before the 10 shows would finally be seen by the British viewers. You see, ITV was still only able to transmit the recordings in black and white.
Wow, gone to those days, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, gee. Though the American venture did not lead to a follow-up season, Eric and Ernie were keen to continue appearing in colour, as you can imagine. Painting all that black and white makeup would be terrible. And Lou Grade vetoed the idea. They signed with Britain's only channeled in transmitting programmes in colour, the BBC Two. It was a monumentous decision that would result in some of the finest television Britain had seen, but first Eric had to survive a serious health crisis.
A fortnight after the season of eight half-hour shows was aired in late 1968, Eric suffered a serious heart attack and was lucky to reach the hospital in time.
Wow. Why would he have a heart attack, Mike?
Well, at the time, he was smoking 60 cigarettes a day.
Holy.
And drinking heavily. He suffered a heart attack on the 8th of November 1968 at the age of 42, while driving back to his hotel outside Leeds.
Where would you find time to smoke 60 cigarettes a day, honestly?
Yeah.
Wow.
Eric had been appearing with Ernie during a week of midweek performances at the Variety Club in Batley in Yorkshire. Now, Morecambe and Wise appeared there in December 1967 for a week, making £4,000. After that, they were booked to play New York Nightclub and the Royal Variety Performance, and then 8 weeks in pantomime in the coming winter.
That's a pretty hectic schedule.
It is.
It is.
Now, Eric was heading back to his hotel, as he recounted in an interview with Michael Parkinson back in 1972. And he said the pains in his chest spread, He became unable to drive. He was rescued by a passerby as he stopped the car. The first hospital they found had no accident and emergency. The second one, a heart attack, was immediately diagnosed.
So he had to go to two hospitals?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. His recovery was slow and frustrating, and for some time there was doubt whether the act would be able to continue. When doctors finally gave Eric the go-ahead to return to work, with a great sigh of relief from Ernie and the BBC, there was a further complication. Contractual problems with scriptwriter Green and Hills had resulted in their signing an exclusive contract back at ATV. Their unlikely replacement, Eddie Braden, was best known for supplying one-liners to various artists like Ken Dodshow. But his contribution to the careers of Morecambe and Wise from that point on turned out to be monumental.
So after leaving hospital, Eric gave up his cigarette habit and started smoking a pipe.
Oh, that'll make a big difference.
Oh, yeah. He reduced many of his public engagements. Eric took 6 months off, returning for a press call at the BBC Television Centre on May 1969. In August of that year, they returned to the stage at Winter Garden Theatre in Bournemouth and received a four-minute standing ovation.
Just for walking on stage?
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, they were very much loved. They had the exposure and the public loved them.
Yeah. Now, Ernie was commonly regarded as the straight man of the partnership, although his role gradually and subtly changed over the years. When Eddie Braden took over as the chief writer, he enriched Ernie's persona by making him pompous and naive. Ernie's character changed from being a conventional straight man into a pretentious and self-satisfied idiot. I wonder if he really wanted to be described as a self-satisfied idiot. Eddie Braden also made Ernie a would-be writer. Their BBC show in the 1970s would always climax with an extended sketch introduced by Ernie as a play what I wrote. It was in such a play that Glenda Jackson, at the height of her career, was made to speak the line, "All men are fools, and what makes them so is having beauty like what I got."
To lessen Eric's workload following the heart attack, the BBC scheduled a season of only four 45-minute programmes to air on a fortnightly basis from late July 1969. As before, the format included a traditional variety mix of guests, vocalists, a regular offering of Kenny Bourne and his Jazzmen, a handful of short blackouts, often involving the antics of a couple of monks, a lengthier piece set in the living room or bedroom of a flat that in which they supposedly lived. The highlight of that first programme was a play what Ernie wrote about King Arthur, with movie great Peter Cushing taking the lead role and launching an ongoing saga in pursuit of payment for the appearances. Subsequent participants in those early Ernest Wise theatrical offerings included Juliet Mills, Edward Woodward. Also seen at the end of each programme was the ample figure of Janet Webb, who, for no apparent reason, suddenly burst forward onto the stage, waving and blowing kisses at the audience as the audience applauded.
For no apparent reason.
For no apparent reason.
Yes. The series was an enormous success, and the only downside to the team's comeback was that year's festive special, which was also abandoned with both Eric and Ernie laid low with the flu, leaving producers to stitch together a handful of pre-recorded segments and musical items by guest stars. In other words, a clip show.
Yeah.
Which seems to be the staple these days. In frequent years, the Morecambe and Wise Christmas show would become essential viewing for half the nation and a ratings Goliath. But that first variety show was maybe not such a success.
Yeah. Despite being screened on Britain's third channel, which could not be received by large numbers of viewers, subsequent BBC One repeats ensured Morecambe and Wise did not lose their late 1960s audiences. As the new decade began, their popularity increased enormously.
A dozen new episodes were shown throughout the 1970s in two fortnightly seasons, with notable guests including Fenella Fielding, Diane...
Salino,
thank you. I nearly mispronounced that. Ian Carmichael and Richard Green. There was also a special half-hour edition entered for the prestigious Montreux Festival and a Christmas offering. It was a remarkable turnaround. A heart attack and a change of writers have propelled Eric and Ernie to the top of British television. Which wasn't hard, because after all, it is British television.
Ooh.
Well, not everybody had televisions back then.
I'd like to just point out it was Chris said that, not me. Emails to him.
Thank you.
The golden era of Morecambe and Wise was underway. The 14 editions produced throughout 1971 included some of their best work. Guests included Flora Robson, Arthur Lowe, cameo walk-ons from Thad's Army cast, Frances Matthews, Keith Michelle, John Mills, Glinda Jackson as Cleopatra, and that Christmas show Shirley Bassey in boots and Andre Previn conducting Grieg's piano concerto.
Was Shirley Bassey wearing anything other than the boots?
I would assume so.
You'd hope so, yes. Classic sketches from such shows often revolved around the guest stars. One example is the 1971 appearance of Andre Previn, who was introduced on stage by Ernie as Andrew Preview. Previn's schedule was extremely tight, and Eric and Ernie were worried that he had very little time to rehearse, but the final result was described by their biographer as probably their finest moment.
The sketch was a rework of one which appeared on Two of a Kind, was written by Sid Green and Dick Hills.
Sid Green, I know that name.
Yeah. The previous writers we're talking about. Actually, if you listen to Morkman Wise doing Boom, Ooh, Yatta-ta-ta.
Oh, yes.
They were the other two guys doing the Boom and the Oohs and the Yatta-ta-tas.
Ah. Boom, Ooh, Yatta-ta-ta.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll add links on the Facebook page.
Yes.
Okay, now the sketch with Andre Previn was a rework of One or Two of the Kind. Now, Previn was initially enthusiastic as a guest, but he is perplexed by the news that he will not, after all, be conducting Yudhi Mendelssohn in Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, but Evert Grieg's A Minor Piano Concerto with Eric as the piano soloist.
I'm glad you got that bit, not me.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he's expecting to conduct an orchestra. No, it's going to be him on the piano.
Right.
Okay, so the sketch went something like Ernie would say, I can assure you that Eric is more than capable. And Previn says, well, all right, I'll go get my bat on. Yes, please do that. It's in Chicago.
In other words, I'm not coming back.
Yeah. At this point in the sketch, Eric punches the air with his fist and ad-libs the line, pow! He's in, I like him, I like him. The television executive Michael Grade has observed that it was Previn's expert delivery of his lines that caused Eric to subsequently relax. Eric's face lit up as if to say, oh yes, this is going to be great. Since Previn hadn't had time to rehearse, his comic timing was a great surprise.
Some people are just like that. They know timing.
Yeah.
And how to get it right, yeah. Eric goes on to treat Previn and the orchestra with a customary disdain in the second movement, not too heavy on the banjos, and produces his own score, autograph copies available afterwards, boys.
Eric's rendition of the piano part is so bizarre that Previn becomes exasperated and tells Eric that he is playing all the wrong notes. Now Eric stands up, seizes Previn by the lapels, and menacingly informs him, I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order. Now, Previn demonstrates how the piece should be played, but Eric, after a moment's reflection, delivers the verdict, rubbish, and he and Ernie walk off in disgust. Previn starts playing Eric's version, and the duo rush back, declare that Previn has finally got it, and start dancing ecstatically. The sketch's impact can be assessed by the fact that 25 years later, London taxi drivers were still addressing Andre Previn as Mr. Preview.
Oh, he would love that, wouldn't he? Yeah, you get Mr. Preview, how you going? Oh my God, that was 25 years ago. You know,
he's remembered.
Well, that's true. Yeah, he sort of made him a bit of a household name, didn't they? After 12 months out of the spotlight, the 1972 Christmas special brought back some favourite guest stars and featured a throwaway jibe about their friend Des O'Connor during a World War I sketch. It was the start of a celebrated feud that would last to the end of their career and included memorable retaliations by Des on their 1975 Christmas show.
Now, it was interesting that after Eric's death, there was a special aired called A Tribute to Eric Morecambe, Bring Me Sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, it meant that famous performers of the time would get up there, do a bit of their act, and say, well, it's been fun knowing Eric is a great guy. Good night. And that was basically the show.
Mm.
Halfway through the show, Des O'Connor walks on stage.
Oh, God.
He says, I have no idea what I'm doing here tonight. Eric never said a kind word about me. Once he was positively rude. I take that back. It wasn't once. It was 15 years. And then he proceeded to tell every Des O'Connor joke that Eric had ever said.
Oh, God.
And it was the most wonderful tribute I have ever seen, and I can't find it on the internet anywhere.
Oh.
Okay, 1976, they were both appointed OBEs.
Yeah, Sir Eric and Sir Ernie.
Then the incredibly popular festive season of 1977, when an estimated 28 million people tuned in to see a chorus line of BBC personalities and Penelope Keith awkwardly climbing down the scaffolding from the unfinished stairway. A daring conclusion to the show featured an unexpected return of Elton John for a vocal after the end credits had rolled.
Right. I like the way it says BBC personalities and Penelope Keith.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that.
Though unknown at the time, the careers of Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise had peaked with their final BBC show. Weeks later, newspaper headlines announced the pair had signed with Thames Television and were headed back to ITV. A major factor in negotiations had been the desire by Eric and Ernie to return to the big screen with Thames, unlike the BBC, then producing movies as well as TV shows.
But the fates began working against them. Writer Eddie Brabham was not willing to move across with them, and the duo's first two programmes, aired as a one-hour specials in 1978, didn't capture the usual magic. In early 1979, Eric suffered more life-threatening heart troubles and was out of action for a whole year, being barely able to take part in a predominantly talk programme with David Frost at Christmas, and their promised return to cinema screens was put on hold.
By the time he had recovered fully, which was a further 6 months later, both Eddie Braden and John Arms had been signed by Thames for their proposed series of half-hour programmes. Disappointingly, these consisted of almost total reworks of the old BBC sketches, with little new material being included.
Eric and Ernie did four seasons for Thames, and in as many years, with original scripting taking second place to the tried-and-true old favourites. At least most of the musical offerings were being done for the first time.
The 1983 Christmas show was notable for including two particularly successful pieces written by their old scriptwriters, Sid Green and Dick Hills. Amongst the inevitable updating of the old Eddie Braden BBC scripts, sadly it was the last programme Morecambe and Wise would ever present.
As 1984 started, Eric's health was once again causing concern, and he was seriously considering devoting his talents to writing books. You see, he had already written a handful of novels. He was also unhappy with the lack of originality in their Thames shows and the disappointing quality of the telemovie called Night Train to Murder as they had recently recorded.
On May the 27th, 1984, Eric took part. Now, this is without Ernie, so he dumped Ernie and gone off on his own.
No, this is just a one-off event.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what he said. It was a one-off anyway. In a reminiscence at a theatre in Twerksbury, as a favour to his friend Stan Stenton. His wife, Joan, who was in the audience, recalled that Eric was on top form.
After the show had ended, Eric had first left the stage. The musicians returned and picked up their instruments. He rushed back onto the stage to join them and played various instruments, making six curtain calls. On finally leaving the stage as he stepped to the wings, he collapsed with his third heart attack. He was rushed to Cheltenham General Hospital, where he died 5.5 hours later, just before 4 a.m. on May 28th, 1984.
Definitely his final performance.
Yeah.
It sort of speaks a lot to the character of the person that he's doing a performance and he can jump on and play so many instruments, one after the other, the talent and everything, and then he must have been really pushing himself right to the end to give that final performance.
But being Eric, I think he might have been playing each instrument very badly.
Probably, yeah. Yes. Now, that was when they did the Bring Me Sunshine tribute show with Des O'Connor, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a great tribute show to him. And, once again, wish I could find that on the internet too. Ernie continued performing. First, a nostalgic one-man tour of Australia, appearances in the West End musical The Mystery of Edwin Dood, and the long-running farce Run for Your Wife, plus a TV panel games and pantomimes. But it could never be the same without his bi-spectacled partner.
He made the first mobile phone call in the UK on the 1st of January 1985 from St Catherine's Dock in East London to Vodafone's headquarters in Newbury, Berkshire. Now, that's something to be to said, making the first mobile phone call. I wonder why they picked him to do that.
No, he's still very much loved as an individual.
Yeah.
In 1990, he wrote his autobiography, Still on My Way to Hollywood. He also was the subject of This Is Your Life, which was transmitted on Boxing Day 1990. His 1992 Christmas single was recommended retail release on Music Week. Ernie was also an active and long-time participant in the Keep Britain Tidy campaign.
On the 14th of May 1994, the BBC aired the first of three episodes of a mini-series called Bring Me Sunshine, as a tribute to Eric Morecambe. It was hosted by Ben Elton, who was a huge fan of Morecambe and Wise, and he cites the duo as being a big influence in his career. Those interviewed were John Thor, Roy Castle, Dinah Rigg, Hale and Pace, and Fry and Laurie, to mention a few very famous names. Ernie was not asked to participate in the BBC show, and they said that they did not want too many talking heads. He was, however, recovering from a minor stroke at the time.
You see, Ernie had suffered a second minor stroke in August 1995, and as a result announced his retirement from show business on the 27th of November 1995, his 70th birthday. In the summer of 1998, Ernie was asked by the BBC to take part in Bring Me Sunshine, The Heart and Soul of Eric Morecambe, which was shown on the 23rd of December. He had agreed to do so, but then his health had begun to deteriorate further. Ernie suffered two heart attacks within a week while on holiday and had to undergo triple heart bypass surgery in Fort Lauderdale in Florida. In March 1999, he was flown back to the London by air ambulance and taken directly to the Nullfield Hospital at Wexham, Buckinghamshire. Ernie Wise died from heart failure and a chest infection at the Nuffield Hospital, Wexham, on the morning of 21st of March 1999. I'll do that again.
Okay.
Ernie Wise died of heart failure and chest infection on the morning of the 21st of March 1999.
And we'll pause and remember that moment for a moment. There's a statue of the guys,
yeah,
if I'm correct.
In March 2010, Ernie's widow, Doreen, unveiled a statue of him in his hometown of Morley, West Yorkshire. It was a statue that was commissioned by the Morley Murals Committee and funded by Doreen.
So she funded the statue of her husband?
Yeah.
That's love and dedication for you. Love that goes beyond the years.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
And a lot of us remember a lot of great shows from Morecambe and Wise. On our Facebook page, I'll be putting up links to lots of YouTube clips. And, that was it. That's the story of Ernie and
Eric. Morecambe and Wise.
Morecambe and Wise.
Yes.
I'm always sad to hear these laugh makers who
We always get to the end of them, don't we? I know we're doing historical hystericals, but it's not really all that funny when everybody dies at the end of it, is it?
Yeah, we must do more live guys.
Yeah. If there's any live comedians out there who'd like to talk to us, we'd love to have you.
Well, we're running over. We must make a move. Contact us on Facebook. That's where you can find us best. Do a search for historical hystericals. Download these podcasts on whatever web catcher you use. I was going to say iTunes, but I haven't used iTunes in about 3 years now.
No, it's, there's so many different podcast things. There isn't a podcast app you can get now, and you can pick us up on the podcast app.
Yeah.
So have a look for that. We're around.
Yes. A quick Google search for historical hystericals will give you us.
Doo-doo, here we are. Hello, waving at you in the corner.
Ooh. Okay, we got to run.
Okay.
Been great talking to you guys. Oh, keep listening. Got a special announcement coming right up. Bye. Oh,
bye.
I haven't the faintest idea why I'm on this show tonight. Eric never said anything nice about me. 1 week on television, he was positively uncomplimentary. Well, I lie, it wasn't 1 week, it was 14 years. Des, short for desperate. Death O'Connor. Desecrated. Ernie?
What?
Des O'Connor's just entered the building. How do you know that? When the guard dog jumps off the roof, Des O'Connor's entered the building. What's the play this week? It's about a man in his 80s. Who's lost everything, his dignity, his voice. Great, but will Des do it? Very sad about Des.
What's happened?
He's had his gallbladder removed. That's nasty. It was for him. It was on the back of his neck. For the past 14 years I've been living with this. People say to me, Des, come on, tell us. Were you enemies? Did you get on well? Tell us the truth. When did it start? It started in 1967. I said to Eric, I want to be an international star. He said, I'd like to have an affair with Brigitte Bardot, but all things are not possible. I said, I'm going to become a singer. He said, I'll join the Royal Ballet. I said, I'm going to be a limited company. He said, you should be, you're a limited performer. I thought, I'm going to prove it to this man. And I went out there and I made records. Hit after hit. Careless Hands, I Pretend. 1, 2, 3, O'Leary. Dick-a-dum-dum. The more hits, the more insults. You can now buy Des O'Connor's new LP in Boots, the chemist. You get it on the poison counter with a prescription. There's only one thing wrong with Des's new LP. The hole in the middle isn't bigger. So I said to him, I said, look, Eric, you shouldn't be in this business if you can't take a joke. And I don't mind this. But one of my fans is very upset. He said, well, let me talk to the other one. I said, it's all these insults. Insults? What insults? Who's insulting you? I said, you are. Saying things like, who discovered Des O'Connor? David Attenborough. They're insults. They're upsetting. They hurt people. I wouldn't hurt anyone. I'm a nice man. It's not me, Des. I don't think of these things. It's our scriptwriter, Eddie Braben. He does it. He works like this. If he hears you do a duff joke, sing a rotten note, he thinks of a gag, sends it to us, we send him a fiver. I said, I want to talk to him. What's his number? He said, it's 051-466-6624-5595-559. I said, is that his number? He said, no, that's his fee for last week. I said, Eric, people are talking. You've got to get on there and say something. He said, all right. So he went on the show. Joan knows this is true. And he said, look, Des and I are friends. As a matter of fact, he came just this week to my daughter's wedding reception. He wasn't invited, but he came. But we were friends. When I had my cartilage removed, or as Eric said, the cartridge removed, he swears someone took a shot at me while I was singing. They came in the pair of the American Ernie. Eric brought a bottle of vintage champagne. Ernie took it home with him. Nice to see Ernie's already working. He's working in the grotto for Santa Claus at Harrods. Harrods says it's the first time in 70 years the grotto's shown a profit. The boys have been good to me. A lot of fun. Of course we're friends. You can't say things like that on the air and get away with it. Well, maybe Eric could. I treasure the memories. I treasure the letters. Had one letter from Eric. It was addressed to Mr. Des O'Connor, the Henry Cooper School of Singing. Dear Desolate, this morning little Ern went out and bought your newest LP. I'm very sorry now I kicked him. Because I've listened to it, and it's great. It's the best you've ever done. An absolute knockout. I've played it non-stop for 3.5 hours, and you'll be delighted to know it's got rid of all the cockroaches. and the gypsies parked half a mile down the road. P.S. By sheer coincidence, as you were singing Little Things Mean a Lot, Little Ern was in the bath. He loves playing with his cassette in there. He loves the LPs. He rushed in from the record shop the other day and he said, Dolly Parton's got one coming out. I said, there's no answer to that. That's when he told me that Ernie had a criminal record. I didn't know it either. I said, he's got a criminal record? What's that? He said, Des O'Connor singing Careless Hands. You couldn't top him. You just couldn't. So it'd be wrong for me tonight not to sing. He wouldn't want that. He'd like to laugh. I shall sing a number a cappella. Musical term for without voice. Well, that's what he said it was anyway. It's a love song, and I'll be singing it to a man. But somehow it doesn't matter, because driving here tonight, I saw the Christmas decorations in Regent Street, and it dawned on me that the brightest light has gone out on the Christmas tree. There may be many other nights like this. Doubt it. When I'll be standing here with someone new. There will be other songs to sing. Another fall, another spring. There will never be another you. You listening, sunshine? There will be other faces, new star names. They'll make us laugh, but somehow not the same. And they may insult my singing, but it began with you. Ever be, you shared this private joke with me, and then you told the whole country. They laugh with you, they laugh with me. Thank you for the memories. There could never ever be another.